I mean, if you're a player that's struggling, and I'm saying not beginner, but somebody who maybe is a 10 handicap, number one rule, one chip per hole, right? Pitch one time, chip one time, get the putter in your hand. But if you're asking more for that high level, high school, college, I think you've got to look at where's the ball going to land.
This is the Tournament Code.
Thanks for joining us today, Chad. We know that you were up at Oakmont the other week with your student, Phil, and he obviously got a little bit of TV time as he made the cut on the number. Before we get into that, though, PuttView Books helps us keep the lights on, and Jack has our trivia question. So every time we do this, we have a PuttView Books opening tee shot, is what we call it. Jack drops a trivia question. None of us three, you, me, Cooper, know the answer to it. And so then we try to come up with the answer. And each time it's a little bit different. It's also pretty interesting. So, Jack, what we got?
So, for context, to those listening at home, we are recording. Tommy Fleetwood is on the sixth hole at TPC River Highlands trying to close out his first PGA Tour win. He has 27 top fives on the PGA Tour without a win. The next closest is 15 without a win. Can you name the players with the five most top fives on the PGA Tour that are active without a win?
Active without a win. I hope my answer doesn't involve your light staying on, because I'm not going to get this in place.
Fortunately, no.
It's a fortunately, big group. No. It's usually a group project.
It has to be a group project.
All right, let's get it started. Patrick Someone Rogers. Else fire one first.
What did you say, Coop?
Patrick Rogers.
He is second. Good work, Cooper. 14 top fives, four runner-ups, no wins.
Surprise, surprise, the wow. Patrick Rogers fan gets it correct.
He does love Patrick, Patrick Rogers. Rogers.
Cooper loves Patrick Rogers.
I'm going to be zero help here, guys. Zero.
We need to name five people, Jack.
Yeah, the five best. We have Patrick Rogers is off the board. And he was probably the easiest one to get.
Oh, no. And they're active. How many are foreign?
Two are foreign. We have one from Asia, one from Europe, two Americans.
Tyrrell Hatton?
No. I didn't count him as active on Live, but I think he won anyway at Bay Hill.
How many did Patrick Rogers have?
He had 14 top fives, name? Four runner-ups.
Has Davis Riley won on tour?
He has. He won one of those team events.
There we go. I'm zero help, man.
No.
Or no, he didn't win a team event. He won at Colonial.
I'm glad you pay attention to this stuff.
I'm Oxley. Alex Trebek. I have the answer, so it's easy to.
Oxley hasn't won, has he?
I think he's won twice.
Really?
Yeah.
Something like that. A game like that is fun. Well, I'll go for the. Does Ryo Ishikawa still play?
I don't think he's active, and honestly, I don't think he has these numbies either.
I don't think so either. I'm stumped on the.
Yeah. No clue.
Oh, come on.
All right. We'll each give one more guess, and then Jack, you got to do it, because otherwise we'll go on for 3 minutes like this and have nothing to show for it. I'm thinking through.
I'll guess Maverick McNealy.
He won like 3 months ago or 6 months ago at Sea Island.
I'm trying to avoid the embarrassment of a name that's already won five times.
Tom Kim's already won.
I think, yeah, he's won like three or four times. It's easy to forget about these. Like, I was looking at these and I was like, surely he's won. Had to go to the Wikipedia profile and hadn't won. And they're all good
players.
They're all good players. Like, they're all probably top. Every single one of these is like a top 40 player in the world, other than Patrick.
It's pretty dumb, but has Shane Lowry won a PGA Tour event?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they won the.
Yeah. And they would count a major as a tour event too.
Okay, okay.
But I like the thought process. He's probably only won twice, and he's up there. Like, not a bad guess.
Robert McIntyre?
Won like two or three times last year.
I thought he won the – is the Scottish the count?
That's tour event. And he won Canada. Although, I guess if we did like has one in America, he'd probably be number one on the list. So I like the thought process.
All right, Jack, just tell us the other ones. Just
number
tell
one
us.
Is Ben On. He has not won. Alex Noren, K Cameron Young. Now this one's interesting. Cameron Young has 10 top fives. 7 of them are runner ups. I don't understand how you have 7 runner ups and haven't won one. That's an incredible like coin flip ratio there. And Denny McCarthy.
Those are interesting ones. At least we got 1 out of 5. Nowhere near passing. As we said, Chad, that keeps the lights on. And we're excited to have you here today on Instagram. I know that your handle is Show Me Your Short Game. So let's just start off with Short Game. We'll get to the U.S. Open and Philip in a little bit. Tell us, and I've seen some of your videos, especially about the, I wouldn't call it the modern technique, but a refining of good short game due to measurement devices being able to tell us what's actually going on. So tell us a little bit about short game, your philosophy, and how, at least on Instagram, I know you coach everything, I think, but how particularly short game has evolved and what you've been seeing there in your teaching.
Yeah, I mean, I'm blessed enough to be at the David Toms Academy. We have everything from TrackMan, Swing Catalyst, Gears, and I've always been a curious person. I will say early in this podcast, I am definitely the worst athlete out of all four of us. Realized that super early in life. Realized I loved golf, and I kind of had to figure out a way to equalize the playing field. I didn't like my buddies, you know, that played baseball year round, beating me at a sport that I practiced all the time. So as a child, I mean, I just chipped the ball and chipped the ball and chipped the ball. After years of doing that, you know, it became easy. I could see a shot and kind of could make it somewhat happen. And then when I ended up at the David Toms Academy, I mean, I have every piece of equipment that I could imagine to measure. So 4 years ago, I started measuring, you know, if I see this type of lie and I imagine this type of shot, let me hit it. Let me go back through the information. Let me see what happened. I mean, I will say, I mean, as you guys know, I've listened to many of your podcasts. There are debates, steep or shallow. I honestly, in my opinion, 38 years old where I am now, maybe I look up at 45 and watch this and go, you know what, I was wrong. But where I am now, I think it depends on the substance that's under the golf ball. So, I mean, for me, I'm in Louisiana. I mean, we have tight Bermuda with massive grain. When I started, you know, working with David Toms and Philip Barbary, I noticed that most of their shots right off the edge of the green were extremely low, and they were extremely good at it. So the moment I put up a piece of equipment behind them, I knew about attack angle, obviously, from teaching in the past, but it wasn't the first thing I looked at. Once I started going back through the information, I realized that's a commonality that these two guys have on those type of shots from those type of conditions. Now, I'm not saying they don't hit different types of shots, but I started noticing that this angle of attack and this low point is well out in front of it, but there was no divot, right? It's not like they're leaving massive divots. It's steep, but it's not deep. And I think that's where we get caught. So I started looking at the technology and realized, you know what? The better the player on these conditions, this is a commonality that I'm seeing. So I have a pretty addictive trait about me, and short game has, over the past 4 years, been my addiction. You know, I may look up in the next 4 years and it may be putting. But right now, when I wake up in the morning and I go to bed at night, it is, man, how do I hit that shot? And most importantly, how do I convey that to my players in a way that they can understand using very complex technology, but get my point across to them so that they can make the motion and they can get the same desired ball flight?
It's interesting you bring up what the conditions are, because I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, and once you get that far north, especially, greens are all bent. There's no real Bermuda almost anywhere, especially around the greens. And so I remember everything was normal, like you're used to that. Then you come down south and you start playing on Bermuda and you're like, oh man, I don't know how to chip. I don't know how to do anything. And then when you go back, the opposite happens. Like, oh man, like every single lie is teed up for me here. It's impossible for me to chunk one. Tell us about your observations in the difference between what's under the ball, determining what maybe the best strategy is, or at least what maybe which strategy is worse.
The way I teach it is you look at the lie under the ball as like a personality trait. So every single lesson that walks in, they have a different personality. Some are difficult to get through to. Some just want to talk. But every single person, just like the lie in a short game shot, has a different personality. Now, with a full 7-iron, I don't see that it matters as much because I have more club speed coming into it. So if I'm a quarter of an inch before the golf ball, who cares? I may hit it 5 yards short, right? But when you're hitting a 7-yard shot, and it requires 9 miles an hour club speed, I need to know what is under the ball and what is my best move that I need to make or motion I need to make to get this ball to do what I want it to do. So the first thing we're going to look at is lie. So for me personally, when I look at it, I'm going to grade the lie 1, 2, and 3. Okay. If it's a 3 lie, that ball is sitting down. The ball is tight. Whether it's grain into me, grain away from me, I'm calling it a 3. If the ball was sitting up really high and it's a perfect lie, you know, like a 4-man scramble, you're going to move that ball. That's a 1 lie. I look at that lie like, okay, just kind of let my brain imagine what it wants to do. And I encourage my players to do this. Like I'm not saying be creative, but let your brain wonder, what can I do here and experiment with it. But if it's a 3 lie, for me personally, I like to get more on top of that golf ball. I like to get the leading edge up a little bit higher. I like to make sure that I secure that ball contact first. And I think when people hear that, they immediately assume that the ball is going to come out fast. Well, if you look at TrackMan and use TrackMan for this information, there is a metric that's called smash factor, right? If you had a driver at 100 miles per hour, your smash factor on a perfect shot should be 1.5. So the ball is going to leave at 150 miles an hour. I mean, I'm hitting some of these shots around here that are 10 and 12 degrees down, fairly square face, and my smash factor is 0.7. So my club speed is 30% higher than my ball speed. So I don't really let the lie determine, I'm going to say how fast I'm going to make the ball leave. I mean, I think that can be taught. I know that can be taught. I teach it daily. I'm just letting that lie tell me what part of the ball I need to hit. Do I need to get more on top? Can I use some of the bottom of the club to get under it to launch it up a little bit? But that's kind of my theory on it, is read that personality trait and let it tell me how to move into the shot.
In order to play a successful steep shot, what does it take or what does it look like? Because the connotations with steep that some people have, and obviously we've discussed it some on the podcast as to why they're wrong, but the connotations with a steep shot are that club goes down and buries. And so when I'm chipping, especially on a wet lie or wet tight lie, and I do the little hit the ground first and either dig in or like dig, pop up, and I hit a little duff it a little bit, some people think, oh, well, I hit the ground first. I had to be coming down steep. And then that must be the end result of almost what everything is, or that must be the inevitable result. If I get too steep, I'm just going to chunk it or hit the ground first. So tell us what goes into a steep shot and what makes it a good, what makes it useful.
I think when you say the word steep, there is a certain thought behind the club should be crashing down, right? But if you think about it more as on a hula hoop, the bottom of that hula hoop, at some point it travels down. At some point there's a small flat surface and at some point it goes up. I personally think and teach steep as where we catch it on the hula hoop. And if you can kind of get that into your mindset of, I'm not changing my motion to be steep. I'm changing my ball position. I'm changing setup to be steeper. But if I want to be more shallow, I'm taking that setup and that ball position. I'm moving it around. So let's say for a shot where it's super grainy, maybe the ground is soft. I really don't want any of that material of the club flipping over grass before it gets to the ball. I'm going to encourage players to get the ball back in your stance. Okay. You know, narrow stance, ball back, maybe in line with your trail foot, trail big toe. And then I'm going to get sternum some degree in front. So I'm not saying hips in front. I'm saying if you put your arms out like an airplane and you lower your lead side, that just moved my sternum forward. So immediately I take that hoop and I just tilted it forward. Flip it around. If I have a shot that's sitting on lush grass and I want to elevate it, over a bunker, okay, I'm going to move that ball forward because the ball has cushion on it, and I'm going to take that hula hoop and I'm going to tilt it back by setting spine angle slightly back. So that's steep, that's shallow. Let's go into the dreaded chunk shot, okay? So this is my theory. You cannot hit what you cannot reach. So if you just think about that, the only reason that you're able to put the club into the dirt is because you're set up in a manner to reach the dirt. So if you're afraid of hitting a fat shot, choke down on the club. Make the lever shorter. Will it bring in a blade? Quite possibly. But what it does, it gives you the option to lengthen the arms, to let the club get longer without the fear of I'm going to bury this club into the ground. Second thing you could do is stand up taller, right? I mean, I hit a shot. You can go see it on my social media. I hit a shot 13.8 degrees down off of a piece of plexiglass, which shatters very easily if you know what plexiglass is. There was not a crack on it. How did I do it? My 60-degree wedge is cut. This is what I play with. It's cut 2 inches short. So my ability to choke down on this club and make that lever shorter to remove the ability to hit the ground is basically gone away.
Let's go quickly talk about making levers shorter. You were at the U.S. Open the other week with your student, Philip or Phil. I don't know what he goes by. And I think I saw that on some of his wedges, he had a mega long grip. What was that about?
So it's the same thing. Now, I've got to say, I've been knowing Philip for 4 years now. His short game was phenomenal. I mean, it is a true work of art to watch him make a shot inside of 50 yards, do what he said it's going to do. So I take a little credit for that. But with the long grip, and being that he had played most of his golf, in Bermuda, he was steep on top of it. I mean, he can play these shots around the green that comes in low, and he can predict to perfection how it's going to skip out of green he lies. Well, we'd started working on elevating the ball slightly, just slightly getting it higher, maybe not as much down, but elevating it higher. So I kind of introduced him to, hey, you can't hit what you can't reach. Right? I mean, if your club is shorter, you can't reach it. So I took a wedge out of my bag one day and cut it down like 3 inches short. And we were out hitting balls. And I said, hey, man, just hit this for me. Just see. Well, of course, he blades a couple of them. And he goes, well, this doesn't work. And I go, well, it does. Because when you're starting to let the bottom of the lever start catching up with the top, right, it's starting to add a higher dynamic loft. That club is effectively getting closer to the ground. Right. So with the short club, I mean, he could throw with the 60 degree, he could throw 58 degrees of dynamic loft and couldn't reach the ground. So we played with it. We experimented with it, talked about it for weeks. Well, I believe he was in Canada last year and he sent me a video and he goes, what do you think about this motion? It was a chipping motion. And I go, man, it looks great, but what is this grip that you have on your golf club? And he goes, well, I didn't really want to cut my wedge down because it kind of changed how it feels. He goes, but I found this long grip on Amazon and I like it. So the way that Philip uses the grip is just how you would think. If the shot requires for a shorter lever, he chokes down. I believe, now don't hold me to it, I believe that grip, and I'll tell you a really cool story about Oakmont last week and USGA and the grip. But I believe the grip is 5 or 6 inches longer than normal. So if you watch him hit some shots where you would normally be holding your grip on the steel shaft, he's holding the grip. So I have to give Philip credit for finding the grip. But I encourage it for most people to just experiment with it. Just give it a shot. See what you think about it. If your tendency is to chunk a ball or hit the ground before it and you're blaming it on different variables, put the long grip on, choke way down. If you blade one, you found the other side of that threshold. So just start working your way back up the grip.
And that made it through inspection at Oakmont?
Here's the story. So it was, we played our practice round Tuesday, Wednesday with Sam Burns and Scotty Scheffler. And there was another short game coach out with those two guys. And he's looking in the bag, and I think Phillips' wedge may be like an SM7, SM8. He likes the old school wedge. He's got a closet full of them. So he's looking in the bag, and he pulls it out, and he goes, "What about this?" And he's talking about the club head, and you just see his eyes, see the grip. And he's like, "What is this?" So I'm explaining it to him, and I mean, we have a great conversation. We have two holes left. And he goes, so he's using this, it's on the lines of, he's using this as a training aid, right? No, we play with this. He goes, "Is that legal?" Now, this is on Tuesday. We tee off Thursday. Well, Philip found it, and I was like, "I assume it's legal." So immediately I answer, "Oh, yeah, I've already checked it." I had not checked anything. I was like, "Oh, boy." So, you know, my job for the week with my player is to keep him cool, calm, and collected, right? I'll handle anything you need me to handle, but if I disappear, don't ask where I'm going, okay? So we get done. He goes, "Hey, let's go eat lunch." "No, I got to go do something." So immediately I run down all the way to the driving range. Couldn't find anyone. So found a security guard. I'm like, "Hey, you've got to tell me where rules official is." And he, "Oh, well, you know, I don't know." "Okay, well, get me in touch with someone." So about 30 minutes later, Philip texts me. He goes, "Hey, I'm coming to the driving range." At this time, he doesn't know that I'm investigating whether or not this grip is legal. So he comes to the driving range. And at this time, I am literally dripping sweat, thinking, "Oh, this is it. I'm not even going to get to see Thursday of the Open with my guy." My phone buzzes, and it's the PGA Tour rules official. And he goes, "You have a question." So I step off to the side, and I explain to him, "Look, I don't really want my player to know about this. You know, it's a stressful moment, stressful week. I got to take care of this." So he goes, "I'll call you back." He calls me back and he goes, "Well, I've got good news and I've got bad news. Good news is we have not tested the grip. So it is right now. We can't say it's legal or not. Bad news is I have to come look at it." So I'm like, "Oh boy." So I pull Philip to the side. And first thing I said was, "You know, I love you, right? And I'm here to protect you. And I'm here to do whatever I can to make sure this week is a success." And so I lay it out to him, and you know, just as cool as he could be, he goes, "No, that's fine. I greatly appreciate you doing that for me." So the rules official comes over and looks at it, and he goes, "You know, I'll quote him. He goes, you know, as far as the rules of golf, you can have a grip that goes all the way to the end of the shaft." So Philip looks at me, and he goes, "Oh, yeah." So we may be experimenting with a little longer grip coming. No, I'm just kidding. But it did pass, and that was hands down the most stressful part of my week at Oakmont was having to tell a player who relies on his ability to chip that ball close and make putts that we're about to have to change something. But fortunately, it passed.
I know you've been working with Philip for about 4 years now, and he was an extremely successful junior player who won the U.S. Junior, good college player. And then I'm not sure if you started working with him when he turned pro or after he turned pro, but I'd just like you to talk about how you guys got hooked up together and what it's been like working with him as he, you know, works his way towards the tour.
So, yeah, so Philip had already turned pro, I believe, 18 months, 24 months before I met him. And one day I was at David Thoms Academy, my phone buzzed, and I looked at it, and I knew who Philip was. We had crossed paths at the academy, but never had worked with him at the time. And he said, "Hey, you know, I'd love to meet with you and see what you think and, you know, kind of give you a shot." And I had heard from around here, and of course, I'm from Mississippi, so I'd heard of Philip being this close to Louisiana. And so we met, you know, hit it off really well, and tell you a good story. We go play 18 holes, okay, my first time seeing him on the golf course. And we play the front nine. And I watch him hit some shots. And I didn't keep score, but I'm guessing he probably shot 38, 39 at our local club here, the club that owns the David Thoms Academy. And he goes in to get something to eat, and I'm sitting in the cart, and I was thinking to myself, and he'll love this story. I don't know if I've ever told him this, but I was thinking to myself, man, if this is what the best looks like, I might could have done this. I might could have played professional golf for a living. So he gets back in the golf cart, and we just start laughing and having a good time. And after six birdies and three pars on the back nine, I realized that there's no chance I could do what he does, right? So I went back home that night, and I sat down. I was like, you know, what did I just witness? Like, I just saw someone play to my level, right? I mean, and then I saw someone play to a level that it looked easy. So we talked a couple days afterwards, and my job with Philip Barbary is to make golf fun. That's what happened on the back nine. Is he settled down, and we became friends on the back nine of East Ridge Country Club that day, and I got to witness what I think is Philip Barbary golf. And how do I work with Philip? I mean, if you watch any of the coverage, I mean, we're hugging on the driving range. You know, we're crying together. We're praying together. Yeah, we work on technique, and I'm not going to let him, you know, get out of position, things like that. We talk a lot about that. But my primary job with Philip is to let him know that you're going to be good at things that you enjoy doing, and that's when you get the best success. You know, when I met Philip, he was actually part-time, I believe, working at his dad's restaurant here in Shreveport. I'm not going to speak for Philip and say he was thinking about giving it up, but I know from talking to him that, you know, it was in his mind, and that's what you don't want to creep into a player's mind like that. And I can tell you right now that is not in his mind. His mind is to, we're getting on the PGA Tour. We putted and we chipped and we drove the golf ball way too good last week to not let the world see how good Philip Barbary can be or is around the greens.
What was the transition like going from Bermuda to Oakmont? And what, especially, you said he has a great short game. What was it like? How did his game adapt, and how did the shots change for him going on that track, especially as it changed throughout the week?
Leading up to the week, he was driving it amazing. Even into the qualifier, he had been driving the ball amazing. I mean, we get to Oakmont on Sunday, and we have literally the golf course to ourselves. So we had made a plan. We're going to play nine holes Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That's all we're going to do. So we go out Sunday and, you know, just play nine, and we're just hanging out. And he would hit some 20, 30-yard shots around the green, and I would stand kind of perpendicular to it, and I'm counting the bounces. Hey, the ball landed, bounce, 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 grabs and releases. So I kind of told him, hey, these balls are, you know, skipping three or four times, then they're grabbing, and then they're releasing, just because there had moisture on it. So immediately, you see, oh, I need to land it 3 feet shorter. Boom. Then we come out Tuesday. I believe it was Tuesday. The greens got a little bit quicker. You could feel it even under your feet. They were firming up. And you could actually see the ball react a little different. The first hop was a little bit higher hop, so it carried a little bit longer, but it maybe only skipped twice and then would grab. So when we went to the chipping green afterwards, I mean, he hit a couple shots. But if you're asking, like, how hard was it, or what did we do to adapt to the fairway? There was nothing. I mean, it was, even though there was no grain, I mean, it was still the way we chip it here. I mean, if you want the ball high, he would open the face, move it a little bit forward. If he wanted the ball to scoot and kind of skid over, break in the green, I mean, we played it the same way we did here. But what was amazing to me as a golf nerd, when he got in the rough, and this is all the players, Sam, Scotty, we play with Keegan. It's amazing to see. You can't practice out of grass like that. I mean, you cannot practice. You can't grow your yard high enough to practice out of that. It was amazing to see these guys hit the shots. And a big word with me is these high-level players are curious, right? They're not stressed to be good. They're curious on how can I get good. You could watch how they would watch those balls react and watch how the club would come through the grass. And then within very few shots, they would completely change, not necessarily technique, but they would change their vision of how the ball was going to come out. and it was just so much fun to watch. But the rough was as brutal, if not more brutal, than you think it is. Like, I couldn't find a rake beside the greenside bunker. It had settled in the rough, and I literally lapped the entire bunker and did not see a rake. And these guys adapted to that. It's insane.
You kind of talked about how they're just really good at figuring it out. And then obviously, if you're at that level, you have like a pretty incredible gift at just figuring out conditions. From your like eyes, how do you think technique changed in that rough? Were they just going like full on bunker shot, flop behind it? Or do you think they had a technique, or was it all just kind of figuring it out on the fly?
So, you know, one of the things I did notice after they would hit those first five or six balls, and they would, you know, either come out dead or not come out at all, started noticing how their finishes got a little bit bigger. So I'm not, you know, yeah, you can see on social media, play it like a bunker shot. I'm not saying that they were hitting it with that much speed around the green, but I think they were definitely prioritizing, let me get my club through this grass. I'm not going to let the grass resist the club coming through it. I mean, I got to be honest, like, I might get in trouble for saying this, but I hit some shots in the short game area. It was very predictable. If there was no bad lie, right? I mean, there wasn't, you know, only place that was unpredictable would be where the spectators walked, right? So if you had that, it's just pretty standard. But as far as like judging how the ball would come out, you could look at it really quick and tell I'm not getting this ball out of here. But as far as the other shots, I noticed their finish got a little bit bigger, backswing got a little bit bigger. I mean, I'll have to ask Philip, you know, what he did. But in the moment, I was definitely not asking any questions like that. You know, it's like, hey, you seem to pick it up pretty good. We'll talk about it later on.
That is cool. What was your biggest takeaway being there this year that you'll carry forward with you as you go, hopefully to more in the future?
You know, I guess on the range, when you hear the word teacher and you see a guy stand behind a player on the driving range, I think it would be a common view as there's a lot of technique being taught, right? I mean, I stood behind four or five guys that we've all heard of that teach people, and listening to them, it wasn't so much of that. You know, it was basically going back and covering things that they had talked about, very, very minor things. You know, like you heard a lot about ball position. You heard a lot about, you know, hey, alignment, things like that. You know, I always thought, hey, when you get to a major and these guys are competing for millions, these coaches that are walking the range, they're probably going to be dropping, you know, knowledge. It's not that at all. It's you've already done all the hard work, right? You're just there to make sure your player's not missing something, one piece that could be worth one shot per day. I think also is, you know, for Philip and I, that was our first major to go to together. And I think we did a wonderful job of staying calm, right? I mean, you got to think on Saturday morning, we came out, he made a 5-footer, 5.5-footer on a 2% slope. If you run the math on it, that 5.5-footer broke between 5 and 7 inches. This was to make the cut at the US Open, and he had the audacity and the knowledge to play it out that far. So he makes the putt. We go to the driving range. Everybody's excited. You know, we have to tee off in an hour. So it's like, how do we settle back down? You know, I think probably the biggest thing is being able to kind of enjoy the moment, stay present, but not let the moment get your heart rate up. Right. Just stay calm. And that's what you really see, or what I thought I saw from these high level players and coaches on the range was it's just another day. They're present. They know where they are, but I mean, it's just another day of golf. You go hit your ball, look for it, and hopefully you get to hit the same ball again.
Absolutely. When it comes to short game, what would you consider your student comes to you? Maybe you've never seen them before. Obviously, you're going to look at everything they do, but what do you look at as like kind of your fundamentals or your fundamental preferences in terms of ball position, grip, how the club is set up? If I want to hit it, let's say, and I'll give us a better color here. Let's say I want to hit a stock little pitch shot, 20 yards to the pin, and I got 10 yards of fairway in front of me and 10 yards of green between us, so 20 yards in total. What are kind of like the fundamentals. Okay, here's what my preference is, at least for option A of this shot, and then working through it.
Yeah, so I think it would depend on what level player we're talking about. I mean, if you're a player that's struggling, you know, and I'm saying not beginner, but somebody who maybe is a 10 handicap, number one rule, one chip per hole, right? Pitch one time, chip one time, get the putter in your hand. But if you're asking more for that high level, high school, college, I think you've got to look at where's the ball going to land, right? So we're going to look at it from the hole backwards. What is the ball landing on? If you're saying it's landing on the green, that's great. Is it landing into the green? Is it landing on a downhill slope? Is it pretty flat? But it's just far as basic. You know, off of Bermuda, if you're, say, a 10-yard carry, my number one would be stance width about, you know, one club head wide. So I'm just giving you basics. Now, everybody can take a variation off of this, but inside of 30 yards, I like to start people off stance width, one club head wide, 30 to 60, we can go two club heads wide, 60 to 90, we can go three. So we're going one club head wide, playing the ball basically in the center of the stance. If you're holding a 60 degree, play the face decently square. You got plenty loft. If you're 54, 56, we could open a little bit to raise the spin loft on it. And, you know, depending on the surface under it, if it's tight, just like I said earlier, I'm going to shift the airplane slightly forward, maybe 2 to 3 inches or 10 to 20 degrees. If it's a good lush lie, I mean, you can keep the spine angle neutral. But I guess for me, I go stance width first. That's what I'm going to look at. You know, 30 to 0 yards, one club head, 30, 62, 60, 93. Then I'm going to look at the length of the lever. So if I'm up close, I'm gripping down on that grip. Like we talked about earlier, Phillip's grip. If you look at him hit some of those basic short shots, he's way down on it. But as he goes from that 30 to 60, we're moving up the grip. As he goes to 60, 90, you know, we're higher on the grip. But it really depends on kind of the level player. I mean, I prioritize contact first. If you can hit the ball the same every time, you can watch that ball and you can predict what it's going to do once it lands. Doesn't matter what loft. If you ask, you know, if someone comes to me and goes, what loft should I use? I know there are different beliefs on this, and I'll tell you why I have this belief, but I mean, rock and roll with a 60, okay? You can do, in my opinion, without opening the club face, you can do more things with spin loft with a square face. So as I start opening the face of, let's say, a 54, yes, I may achieve the same spin loft, right? But unless those grooves are milled a little different, you've got some new technology. When you open those grooves, you potentially could be losing friction because now the grooves and the club path are moving in opposite directions. So by holding that 60 degree, you're maintaining friction on that. So I like my players to use higher loft. I have probably measured past 4 or 5 years, I mean, thousands and thousands of shots. I very rarely see someone take a 60 degree static loft and deliver above 50 degree dynamic loft. So you're holding a 60, but you're delivering lower with the square face. Now, if they open the face, I clearly see higher. So I just want you to have that little bit extra buffer in the game to kind of slow that ball down, right? If they come in, you know, I have players all the time, teach me how to spin it. Teach me how to spin the ball. Make the ball stop. Okay, great. I think two things go into making a ball stop. Number one is increasing the spin, obviously. But number two is slowing down the ball speed. Like if we went out and chipped right now, you would watch me hit balls and say, man, you spin it a ton. No, my ball leaves a little bit slower than yours. You may spin it more than me, but my ball is going so slow that the spin rate can actually slow down that forward progress a little bit faster. And I just find that easier to do with players with a 60 than I do a 54 and 56.
I've heard it said with full swing, the game in large part is about, you know, maximizing that ball speed. And with short game, it's about minimizing that ball speed relative to the swing that you're making. So when it comes to the strategy for slowing down ball speed, everyone might hear that and they're like, okay, well, the most obvious way to slow down ball speed is to like slow down club head speed in some ways.
Absolutely.
That's the number one obvious way. In terms of getting your students to be able to slow down ball speed, what does it look like? Like, what are some of the strategies you have for slowing down ball speed on their short game so it's not just hopping off the face?
Most amateurs that come in, right, they have this level of anxiety on chipping where I know my club is traveling slower than I set my man. Right there, I see the hand up, right? So I know that was pretty good. I know that my club's coming in slower than a 7-iron. And if I miss hit it at all, I'm doomed, right? So for me, the first thing I'm going to do to slow down ball speed is I'm going to teach you to make the lever shorter. I'm going to remove the fear of you touching the ground. Okay. I'm just going to take that out of the equation. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to low face a couple. Got you right where I want you. Okay. Now slow down, right? All of a sudden, you're taking a low face shot that's normally over the green. You're learning to kind of reel it in. Club speed goes down. We've now got a manageable ball speed. I think one of the best things to learn a good ball speed around the green, when you go out and chip, take three clubs. Take your 60, take your 7-iron. Yeah, write this down. I see him get the notepad. Take your 60, take your 7, take your hybrid. Okay, 60, 7, and hybrid. Start out chipping with your hybrid. Because if you think about smash factor, what is smash factor? It's measuring how fast the ball projectiles off the face. That hybrid's going to have probably a 1.35, 1.4 smash factor. You're going to need to slow the club speed way down for that. Once you go to the 7-iron, you may be looking at a 1.2, 1.25. You're going to get to speed it up a little bit, but not much. And then when you go to the 60, you're going to see that you can actually get these balls to the hole with way less speed than you thought you could before. So once I've looked at club speed, I also like to look at where we contacted on the face. Okay. If I'm really trying to get a slow ball speed, I mean, I'm hitting a shot or getting a player to hit a shot that's downhill, down green. If you think about a trampoline, if you're going to jump on the trampoline, where are you going to jump the highest? In the center. If I want to jump with the same amount of effort, if I want to jump lower, you get over on the outside. Get it on the toe. I mean, I know that's a crazy thought for most people, is I'm trying to hit it centered every shot. On a full swing, you are. On a full swing, you won't center contact, as far as I know, on every shot. But on short game, utilize the toe. As far as setup, how could you use the toe? I would say, number one, most people swing too hard around the greens, way too hard. Number two, they allow the heel of the club to sit on the ground, and the toe is off the ground. There you go. There's another reason you would hit it fat. I like players to get, especially, 10 yards and in, get the heel off of the ground and get the toe on the ground. I want you to think about the toe is what's going to contact that ball. Now, if you go to like really lush grass, you can set up, in my opinion, a lot more different ways, heel down, center down, toe down. But if it's tight Bermuda, I don't really want the heel of the club doing any type of interacting with the ground.
What does that look like in terms of setup? Let's say I'm chipping it, but I'm going to open up the face a little bit. One of the easiest ways, at least, and maybe this is just from my perspective as to what's going on, one of the easiest ways to get that face open is, you open up the face and then a lot of times you drop the hands down a little bit. I'm trying to think about why I do it, but that's just naturally what happens. You drop your hands down a little bit and the heel starts hitting the ground. What would you... Is that even necessary, I guess, is the question?
Yeah, so out of a bunker, absolutely, right? Out of a bunker, I'm going open face, which sends the face vector for a right-handed player, would send the face vector to the right. So then to counter that, you're going to lower the grip to then change the dynamic line, pull the face vector straight. For me on short game, unless the line's perfect, I don't really want the heel of the club to get into that ground a lot. So for instance, like... when David Thompson here hitting balls, I mean, he can fillet the club face wide open, dead square stance. I mean, it looks like the ball's about to go 40 degrees to the right and the ball goes dead straight. For him, it's how I think, and I haven't measured this, say, using with gears on his wrist or with hack motion, but he's doing it by shifting that club path. Right? I mean, his swing plane This is where we go back to some of these debates that you've all heard, steep swing plane versus shallow. If your club face is open and you have a shallower swing plane, you're going to hit it to the right just because of the direction that club's coming in. But with DT, I mean, I watch him hit balls, and I would never mention this to him, and I hope he never watches it because I don't want to have to answer this question, but his swing plane is 80 to 85. So when the face is open like that, it's easy for him to kind of throw that club past his hands and send that face vector going more left. But, I mean, I have probably, I don't know the ratio, but I would say 50-50. Half of my players open the face, aim left. The other half open the face, vertical swing plane, and or the swing plane gets steeper, and they swing left. But what they're not doing is they're not allowing, especially in tight Bermuda, they're not allowing the heel of the club to interact with that ground.
Interesting. That's helpful. How many players do you have using the mega long grip right now?
I don't know. I'll say this. I have more players that have their wedges cut. Now, they're 60, and we'll go into this also, but I have more players that had their 60-degree cut 2 inches short than I do the mega long. I think the mega long is because Philip liked maybe the way the swing weight is, and I actually have to say I kind of like the way it feels too, but I have way more players that have a 60-degree that's cut 2 inches short than I do the mega grip. Because if you think about it, you have 14 clubs in your bag. You have a 60-degree, and you have a putter. So the putter goes shorter than the 60. So you have 12 other clubs that go longer than your 60, right? Why do I need to hit my 60 85 yards? This is a concept that I just can't comprehend. It's like, I'll ask you this question. When you're using your putter, what part of the golf course are you typically standing on? The putting green.
Usually the green.
Usually the green, right? And unless you're the DOD king, when you're using your driver, where are you standing? Typically on the tee box, right? For me and my players, I say your 60-degree is, you know, 50 and 60 yards and in. There's no reason to push it any further than that. You can open the face of a 56. So once you start making that wedge shorter, right, and you're trying to carry a ball 50 yards with a normal length club, now all of a sudden I cut my club 2 inches shorter. I have to swing a little bit faster to get it to go there. The byproduct is higher spin rate. So there's one way that anybody watching this can create spin is as you increase the speed with a wedge and you hit it equally as solid, the spin rate goes up. So as I cut that club down, 50 miles an hour doesn't get the ball to go 50 anymore. It may get it to go 39. So I would encourage people to experiment with thinking about the 60 as a tool that's meant for a certain yardage and not meant for my 100 yards and in. You hit your 7-iron how far?
I think we all hit it about 180, 185.
Dang, you boys hit it a long ways, man. Okay, bad example.
Cooper wakes up in the morning with 130 driver speed.
It's like 200 for me.
Are you being serious right now?
Yeah, he's serious.
Yeah.
My man. Congratulations, okay? But seriously, if you hit your 7-iron 200, what is the shortest you would hit it?
I mean, I could probably 180.
Well, okay, so a 20-yard variance. You would go from 200 to 180, okay? Why do we ask people to hit their 60-degree with a 100-yard variance? You have one club that you're asking for a 100-yard gap. That blows my mind. I don't understand that concept. You know, I would rather have a club, whether it's changing the material or changing how it reacts, that it can't go more than 50 yards. And that's my 50 yards in the end shot. But I mean, that's my thought on, but you asked to go back, how do I slow ball speed down? That's another way. I simply make the club shorter. So now the mass is decreasing, right? I don't have as much weight on the club. We even take the clubs here. I'll tell you about my wedge in the bag, but we even remove some of the head weight. So the mass goes down. So when these players are hitting it at, you know, 42 miles an hour, there's less mass. The ball is accelerating off the face less. But the current 60-degree in my bag has 0 degrees of bounce. It's 2 inches short. It's literally 0 degrees of bounce. Nothing. It came off the tour van, measured at zero.
Wow. Yeah, I've heard of that. That's not. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, but haven't hit. I'm not saying I want low face one every once in a while, and I'm not saying zero bounces for everyone, because if I were more than likely playing in the U.S. Open last week, I might would have looked for a little something else. But this is for me. If the way I look at it is, if I can learn to hit this, maybe if bounce is real and bounce helps you, maybe if I added six or eight, I would be that much better.
I've heard people describe really, really good tour short games as like, it sounds clanky or it feels like they're chunking the ball. I don't know. It's like, I forget which guest told it. It was maybe James Seekman who was talking about that. But it's like, you're not actually trying to hit, like make really good contact. You're actually trying to get the least amount of ball speed possible. And it doesn't even sound like a solid strike when you do that. It doesn't, you know, but that's what's going to really just make that ball just land extremely soft without spin. You don't need spin, like you said.
I mean, you don't. I mean, there's certain shots. And let's say this. So if and you guys are, you know, tournament players, you guys are looking for both ends of the spectrum. You need, if you want to be able to spin it, you need to be able to create spin. But you're also looking for the shot where I don't want spin. I need predictability. But let's talk about the average club member that comes in here. What do they want to do from 60 yards? I want to rip it back. I don't care if I have a 6-footer or if I rip it off the green. I want to rip it back, right? I mean, those guys are a little bit different than tournament players. And I think as a good coach, I've got to be able to give you what you want. I need to know how to do all of this, right? I need to know how to give you spin if you want to rip it back, but I also need to know how to tell you to take spin off in order to be a successful coach.
When you said earlier, you know, cut off 2 inches and ball or carry might be 39 or something like that with the same 50. Is that about what the ratio is when you cut off that 2 inches? Because I'm used to, you know, matching club head speed with ball speed and then carry is almost about the same as well. Is that drop off what you've seen with about 2 inches?
I wouldn't say that's an exact number. I mean, so I'll say for me with my club that I have that's 2 inches short with a square face, maybe if I'm swinging at 48 miles an hour, I'm probably carrying it with full length and everything. I'm probably carrying it right at, you know, 50-ish because smash factor is going to be around 1.0. As soon as I cut it down and I have the ability to know I'm not going to hit the ball fat and I can deliver a little more loft, I mean, I'm probably dropping off 4 to 7 yards off of it. So if you think about it, you know, I get to swing, I don't know what the math would be exactly, but maybe 5% faster and to get the same shot. So now you're talking maybe 600 to 800 revolutions of spin more. That's massive, right? I mean, that's massive for the guy that's never spun a golf ball back. You know, but I just personally think at 38 years old in 2025 that the saying you can't hit what you can't reach is massive for people that fear chipping. Just remove the ability to hit the ground. Just get that out of the equation.
That is this, so on Phillips 60 with the mega long grip, is that one cut down 2 inches and mega long grip or regular length mega long grip?
His is regular length mega long grip.
Okay. And you mentioned taking off some weight on the club head. Is there anything else? Obviously, we talked about, you know, just swinging a little bit slower in some ways can help you decrease ball speed. The other way, as we mentioned, is by cutting down that lever, we can bump up spin as well by having to create more club head speed in order to hit the ball the same distance. What are there any other ways, like with equipment wise, that you've seen that have helped out with your student short game?
As far as slowing the ball down, I'll go to that one first. Slowing it down, you can obviously open the face. I mean, that's an easy one. I leave that one kind of the back pocket. I mean, I think you need to be able to secure contact first, like a lot, very consistent contact before we start opening the face. But if you're looking to slow the ball down, obviously open the face. But as far as like a universal how can I get someone wedge play better? I see that with, because if you think about how long the club is, if the club is too long, when the club sits on the ground, the toe's up. The first thing I'm going to do when I measure a player, if they struggle with a heavy shot, is I'm going to take it to the lie loft machine and I'm going to start flattening the club off. I'm going to start moving the toe down, getting it away from the heel, right? If you're going to bounce, in my opinion, I want to bounce with the club flat on the ground and not try to bounce it with the heel on the ground. I mean, I would say, 90% of my people, if your club is not short, then it's flat. It's flat. We've got the toe bent away from the shaft just to give you that little bit extra security. But if you're asking for spin and solidness, this one's easy. Keep your clubs clean, boys. Keep your clubs clean. Keep the grooves fresh, okay? Here's a free piece of gold for you. I know golf clubs are expensive. I know they are. Have a practice set and have a playing set, right? Practice out of the sand. Practice whatever you want to do. Beat the center out of the club face and then put your other clubs in when you go play. Keep those grooves as fresh as possible all the time.
It is insane how much of a difference that makes even recently. I have a, yeah. I've always, at least for the past couple of years, I've always had a practice set and a play set. And I've been busy a lot, and so I haven't replaced my main wedges. I hadn't replaced them in 2 years, but I also wasn't playing like 50 rounds a year. I was playing like 15 rounds a year or something like that. But I also wasn't practicing that much either. But I was like, all right, I'm gonna replace them. And it's crazy the difference that it made just in my short game, how the club felt, but also how soft the ball was off the face. It was completely different. I went from my short game was bad, and there's some things I worked on with my coach to all of a sudden get it to be very passable. But then when I switched clubs as well, all of a sudden, not only were the shots coming off nice, but they're coming off a lot softer and a little bit spinnier. But especially spin was honestly the thing that saved me. It was like the nice thing is like, oh, okay, oops, I accidentally hit that one too far, but spun it so much that it's not going to matter. And then the softness is what kind of helped propel some of the better shots is, okay, this shot around the green, I hit it well because it was so soft off the face, as opposed to just clanking off of it. The other thing you said earlier was you're talking about bounce on your club. And you said bounce. I think you said if it's even real, if it even works. What did you mean by that?
So let's think about it like this. Now, again, I'm going to keep saying this over and over and over. I'm 38. I'm a curious person. I only know what I know. I only know what I test, and I only know from talking to people that are smarter than I am. But let's talk about this. Let's say I'm holding a 60 degree, and it has 10 degrees of bounce. Okay. I don't measure a lot of shots with a 60 degree, like I said earlier, that deliver above 50 degrees of loft. Most of them, I would say from a good short game player, they're de-lofting at 12 to 15 degrees. So let's just call it 15 degrees de-lofting. Well, if I have 10 degrees of bounce sitting on the back of the club and I de-loft at 15, there's net, effectively, I have no bounce in that shot. Does that make sense? Right. So the way I think about it now, obviously, I think that there's bounce. I think there's relief. I think there's glide. So I said my wedge had zero bounce, but when you open the face or even leave the face square, that club is not straight up and down. It's just flat across the bottom. So it will still glide. It will still bounce. But I don't have to worry about when I'm trying to deliver, let's say the high shot we were talking about earlier, over a bunker. I like to play it square. Let's say that I'm hitting the shot and I want it to stop. I need friction, so I'm going to go square face. So the way I get it to go high is I'm going to try to deliver 60 degrees of loft with a 60 degrees of dynamic loft with 60 degrees static loft. So if I'm bringing that club in and I'm realigning the head below the shaft, I don't want that 10 degrees of bounce extending down below that leading edge. That personally frightens me. off the conditions that I currently play on in the South. That frightens me to know that there's a little bit of metal sitting under that leading edge, and that leading edge is now elevated 6 millimeters above the south pole of the ball, right? So that's a beautiful thing about year 2020. I think it started in 2023, maybe, the whole steep, shallow, no bounce, bounce is. I mean, in a couple of years, there's going to be so many new terms and thought processes with wedges where the word bounce has been this universal word. So when I say I have no bounce, that's typically what people hear is, oh, he's got no relief. No, I have relief. It's just not in the phrase of a rounded bottom. I still have tons of relief on the bottom of it. Does that make sense.
And for, I guess I'll repeat it. So to make sure that we have it, you're just saying like the club's still there. It's not like you're swinging with a shovel or something of that nature where it hits and won't go through the ground, but you're not swinging in a scenario where the bottom of the club, if you're hitting it or if you're swinging square, the bottom of the club, so not the leading edge, but the middle of the club won't hit the ground first. That's what you're saying, right? If I took my club, I have leading edge, middle of it, that middle is lower than my leading edge. And so if I, all things being equal, swung in, if I set that on the ground, my leading edge would be above the ball, i.e. somewhat thinville, all things being equal.
That is accurate. Yeah. Like, you know, I think Ping just released a study, right? That like X percent, mm-hmm. maybe it was 80-90% of shots, wedges hit the ground before the ball, right? Is that because there is bounce on the bottom? What would the ratio be if there were no bounce on the bottom? Like, I don't know. Like, these are things I get curious about. And over the next couple of years, I hope to meet enough people that we can test this with the proper equipment and go, well, yeah, there's certain times you need bounce, but there are also certain times that maybe in certain conditions that's not necessary.
That's interesting. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. You've kind of jumped all over today in terms of what we talked about, but our last question is the same for every guest. So for you, we'll go two-parter. We didn't talk much about your golf background, but if you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be? And then for the second part, if you could tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
Always stay curious. Don't get caught up in results. I mean, if you look at people that are successful in what they do, they have the ability to stay curious for a long period of time. If you look at people that get consumed by something and they burn out and they want to quit and they stop asking the right questions, they're more result oriented, just like I was as a kid. Like, I thought my identity was based around the number that I put up. And I would just go back and tell myself there's no reason to slam a club, and there's no reason to say I suck at this, and there's no reason to judge myself based on my peers. Stay curious, figure it out. My advice to another junior, oh, this is good. My advice to another junior or other juniors, your parents are there to help you. I see too often kids get upset with their parents, right? I have a 5-year-old, I have a 1-year-old. I know at some point they're going to go, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about in golf. I know it's coming, right? And it's going to be hilarious when it happens. But I want every kid that's watching this to know your parent is there for you. They're supporting you. They're not your enemy. They drive you to lessons. They pay for your lessons. Love your parents. Enjoy the ride with them, and stop getting so upset at your parents. They're doing the best they can.
Excellent. We appreciate that. That's great advice to honor thy father and mother on this Sunday. In terms of where people can find you on social media, where can they find you?
So I post all of my stuff currently on Instagram. The handle is Show Me Your Short Game. And you'll see on there I do full swing tips. I do putting, chipping. But the thing I've really gotten into now is challenging these good players. You get 9 balls. I get 9 balls. I put $100 in the hole. If you chip in before me, you get the 100. If I chip in before you or no one chips in, I keep my money. And you guys will have to watch the video that comes out with Philip in probably the next 5 or 6 days to see what happens. Pretty good.
Excellent. Excellent. We're looking forward to it. If you're listening right now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, please like, subscribe, leave a rating. If you're trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and on Twitter/X at Tournament Code. As always, we appreciate you joining us. Look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.